This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. What does the race for the Republican presidential nomination look like after the dust has settled from the Granite State? Florida's Marco Rubio roared into the New Hampshire primary with the wind at his back, and while he left disappointed, he vowed to come back stronger in South Carolina. Meanwhile, Ted Cruz continues to do well. Both he and Rubio head to South Carolina and in the mix of candidates jockeying for position behind frontrunner Donald Trump. Here are two Latinos with a decent shot at the nomination, if not the White House. But what do Latino voters make of them? What are you expecting from Cruz and Rubio in the next Republican debate? Rubio's mentor and friend turned rival, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, finished fourth in New Hampshire, yet he took that as a victory, albeit expensive, saying the primary had reset the campaign. And he now turns to South Carolina with renewed energy. But how much longer can the Bush campaign keep going? Do you expect to see either Jeb or Rubio in Florida by the time of the Sunshine State's primary? On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders supporters celebrated a resounding win over Hillary Clinton. But with the Democratic Party's superdelegates, will that win mean much in the long run for the Bernie campaign? Are Florida Bernie supporters buoyed by New Hampshire? Can he upset the Hillary juggernaut? We're taking your calls 1-866-338-5252. And later in the program, Seminole County bans fracking. Is this just a gesture? Could your county be next? Morgan & Morgan takes on Monster energy drinks, and the marijuana industry could be worth millions to Florida. Will that be a factor in your vote on the constitutional amendment in November? 1-866-338-5252. And joining me in the studio, Mike Lafferty, former editor with the Orlando Sentinel. Thanks for coming in, Mike.
Pleasure to be here.
Also joined by Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Good to see you again, Frank.
Good morning.
And Maria Padilla, editor of the Orlando Latino blog. Thanks for coming in, Maria.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a look at the state of the presidential primary races as the candidates head to South Carolina. Marco Rubio was not able to capitalize on the momentum he got from Iowa. He tumbled to fifth place in the New Hampshire primary. And he acknowledged he didn't perform well on the debate stage the weekend before. His answers and the attacks from Chris Christie spawning criticism that he was quote-unquote robotic. So what does he do from here? Can Rubio reveal a hitherto unseen ability to speak off the cuff? South Carolina is a different proposition, though, from the independent streak shown by New Hampshire voters. Here's political commentator Chris Carmody on WMFE earlier this week.
For South Carolina, they are very honed in on this. They're paying attention. For the Republican Party, it's the third primary. The Democrats, it'll be the fourth for them. So, you know, in a lot of ways, you still got a very fine-tuned voter. You got a big military presence. You've got a conservative base, but it's both religious and, if you will, like Main Street conservatives. So, it's a little diverse there. I think we're going to see an interesting spread there.
So it's an important state for both Jeb and Rubio, and it's also important for the Democrats. Political commentator Dick Batchelor told WMFE the South could be a wake-up call for Bernie Sanders.
When you get to the South, particularly South Carolina, 50% of the Democratic vote is African-American. Hillary polls about 85 to 90% among African-Americans. She goes to Nevada where the Hispanic vote, so I think she has a chance. She has a firewall there. Hope she can withstand it.
Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton already has her sights set on Florida with a campaign stop plan for South Florida next week. Bernie supporters, are you anxiously awaiting for your candidate to make a visit? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Well, the GOP field is pretty scrambled at the moment, too. What will it look like in a month when Florida holds its primary? Is Donald Trump the best bet to beat the Democratic nominee? Is Marco Rubio still your candidate after New Hampshire? Can Jeb cling on? 1-866-338-5252. Frank, let me start with you. Jeb says New Hampshire reset his campaign, but was that really a victory for him?
You know, I would think top two or even top three would have been a good reset for Jeb. I don't think it was a reset. I think he was trying to play it off as positive as he could. I think he saw perhaps jumping ahead of Marco Rubio on some of the other contenders that aren't even in a race anymore as sort of a victory for him. But I don't think it was as big a victory as he needed. Now he's moving into South Carolina, where he's got the support of Tim Scott, Lindsey Graham, mm-hmm. and some other supporters down there. And that's where any reinvigoration of his candidacy, if any, will take place in South Carolina. We'll have to see.
What about Rubio's finish in New Hampshire, coming in fifth? Was that a surprise to you, Frank?
Gee whiz, you just compare one week to the next. In Iowa, he finished with that strong third place, and he was really charging into New Hampshire with a full head of steam. And then he had that Saturday Night Debate performance where Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor, just really took him down and exposed his strategy on the stump. And he just sort of lost the wind in the sails, and it was a disastrous New Hampshire showing for him. And he even admitted it, that it all fell on him in that debate performance mm-hmm. at a press conference that night.
Didn't help Chris Christie, though.
No, it did not. Chris Christie jumped out of the race right after New Hampshire. He essentially just made a mad dash for Rubio, did some serious damage before ultimately doing himself in. So it was funny how the dynamic between those two candidates really worked in going into that week leading up to New Hampshire.
Well, do you see Rubio turning it around in the next couple primary states?
You know, he's still got a remarkable amount of charisma. He does have some loyal supporters. I wouldn't say it's over for him. It's just remarkable how up and how high he was riding one week and how low he was sinking the next. It's going to be more of a grind in, as he moves here in the next coming days, and we'll see what kind of traction he can get. I think it is possible for him to sort of climb out of this funk he's found himself in. But you know, it's going to be up to him and what happens in the campaign trail in the coming days.
Maria Padilla, do you get the sense that either of the Democratic candidates, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, have a lock on Latino voters? You heard a bit of that last night. They made a pitch for Latino voters, African-American voters, pretty much covered the whole spectrum there. And you had a political commentator, Dick Batchelor, say earlier that Hillary's got those Latino voters. But what about Bernie? Does he have some traction with the Latino voters?
I'm not sure. Having said that, I will say most Latino voters are heavily Democrat, but that does not mean that they will be reliably Democrat each and every election. And I think here in Florida, for instance, we have seen how Latinos will vote Republican if they want to. They heavily supported Jeb when Jeb was running for office both times. At the same time, however, Florida has also voted for Clinton, for Bill Clinton, for president. So you can see that we are a swing state, and I think that Hispanics in Florida, and I think nationwide, but particularly in Florida, they do swing from one party to the other. They're not entirely committed, even though the bulk of Latino voters do tend to be Democrat.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose there's, you know, the immigration rate in Florida is pretty high from other states as well, so we do get voters from other parts of the country. They're not necessarily, you know, set in stone, so to speak, in Florida.
That's true. We do have very high immigration rates here in Florida, but we also have groups such as the Puerto Rican groups who come and they are automatically citizens, so they can vote without any barrier once they arrive here, as soon as they register to vote. And right now what you have is a sort of a balancing act going on between the Cuban vote in South Florida and the potential Puerto Rican vote in Central Florida, and whether or not they may cancel each other out. It's going to be very fascinating to watch in this election cycle because Cubans tend to be more Republican and Puerto Ricans tend to be more Democrat.
There is a generational gap too, though, in some respects, with Cuban voters now, this generation, and maybe the older generations of Cubans.
That is true. The younger generations of Cubans are trending Democrat. And I would like to see, for instance, how much support they give to Marco Rubio, who is from South Florida, is a Miami-born Cuban-American. And I think, do they like him? Will they follow him? Will they vote for him? I don't know.
Going to take a call now. We've got Mitch on the line. Mitch, you've got some thoughts about Bernie. What's on your mind?
So I was just calling because, in my mind, when I'm looking at the Democratic primary, I think it's somewhat disingenuous the way that Bernie Sanders is proposing a very broad socialist agenda. I'm sure your panel would agree that the idea of, even with a sweeping victory, there's just very little to no chance that he would get a presidency where he would have control of the House or a supermajority in the Senate, such as Barack Obama had in 2008. And even with both houses, Barack Obama was not able to pass a health care law that had a public option. So the amount of things that he is proposing without a, you know, socialist ticket behind him across the state that would support his agenda, there's just really no chance that any of those proposals would get passed.
Here's a question, though, Mitch. Would you also say that, you know, Bernie's been a politician for a long time? He's not, you know, he's not new to the game, so he kind of knows the difference between, you know, retail politics on the stump and the realities of governing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there's an opportunity for him to try and reach across the aisle, but given the intransigent Republican Party that we've seen for the past 8 years under Obama, it's very far-fetched to me to see that he's going to come in and get a lot of the things he's talking about, where, you know, raising taxes, which is often a non-starter, or universal health care, expanding Medicare, things like that, that I don't think he has the political capital to get past. Again, Barack Obama had a lot of progressive agenda in 2008, at which time he spent all of his political capital to try and pass the ACA, which was a huge accomplishment, but even he didn't get past what he wanted in it. And there were still a lot of things that were left on the table, and I don't see how, you know, Bernie Sanders is going to be able to accomplish a lot of these goals. Mm-hmm. And some of his, even his proposals are dependent on state involvement, and given the idea that overwhelmingly Republican governors control a lot of the states with Republican state legislators, such as here in Florida, it just seems very unlikely that the, you know, ticket that he's running on, the issues he's campaigning for, are going to have any real traction.
Well, Mitch, thanks for your input there. I do appreciate your call. Maria, what do you think about that? Is Bernie kind of running on an idealistic ticket that might kind of hit the ground or come down to earth in a tough way if he were to be the nominee and perhaps beyond that?
I think so. Repeatedly during the debates, when the moderators asked for details on his proposals, you really don't get a whole lot of proposals. And you don't get a lot of detail there. And then they ask Hillary, and Hillary takes out her white paper that's, you know, 20 pages long, giving you detail, and in some ways boring you to death. But I think going forward, Bernie has another problem, which is that unlike New Hampshire and Iowa, the rest of the states going forward are much more ethnically diverse. Mm-hmm. And Bernie has the job of having to introduce himself to this population group. Even though he's been very liberal all his life, I think people really don't know him outside of Vermont, right, and maybe outside of New York, which is where he was born. And I think he has to introduce himself to black voters, particularly in places in the South, because black voters are much more heavily concentrated in the South as well. And I think definitely Latino voters don't know a whole lot about Bernie Sanders, and they might be asking, who is this guy? So he has that hill to climb in terms of selling himself to a much more diverse voter group.
Let me just pick up on that populist thread and turn to you now, Mike Lafferty. Bernie Sanders clearly sort of tapping into a sort of populist strain of dissatisfaction with what's going on in Washington now. And I want to just kind of pivot to another candidate who's a populist who's doing well on the Republican side, Donald Trump. He's polling pretty well among Florida voters, but, you know, Maria makes the point that it's a pretty diverse population of voters down here. Do you see some of those poll numbers translating into a win for Donald Trump, or do you think Florida could be a wake-up call for him?
Well, yeah, Donald Trump is polling actually very well. He's in the 40s. A Florida poll, you know, Real Clear Politics averages these polls together, and their latest average that I could find goes back into January, which sometimes seems like, you know, an eternity ago. But Trump was at 40%, Cruz is at 19%, Rubio's at 13%, and Jeb Bush is at 9%. So he's clearly, people find something attractive in him, and you know, it would be a little surprising, though, if voters in Florida continued to feel that way, because if you go back and look at who won primaries in Florida in the past on the Republican side, it's always pretty much been the candidates you would expect. It was Mitt Romney in 2012. It was John McCain in 2008. It was George Bush back in 2000. So it's not like Florida voters do what some other states do and go with some sort of, you know, outlier candidate, you know, like Rick Santorum did a few years back.
Mm-hmm. You've been kind of reporting on you know, what's happening in Florida politics over the past couple of decades. You've seen the rise of the Tea Party. So, I mean, does it surprise you, Mike Lafferty, to see that Donald Trump is sort of riding this wave of popular support when you look at what's happening in Florida?
It does surprise me, yes, because as I mentioned a moment ago, Florida is not one of those states that goes with it tries to make a statement with its candidates on the GOP side. And so I think it's very surprising. But, you know, maybe not so much, because Pew did a survey last year, and it was really interesting. It was asking voters whether or not they preferred experience or new ideas. And on the Republican side, the poll found that the candidate that Republicans wanted new ideas in big numbers. And so when you look at Donald Trump, it's maybe not so much that his ideas are all that new, but that he seems new and he seems different. And that seems to be tapping into maybe what that Pew survey found last year. And this was and that survey was done right about the time that Jeb was, you know, Jeb was at his peak and before his big polling crash came.
Mm-hmm. Let me just come back to the idea of something new. And Maria, you've been writing on your blog, OrlandoLatino.org, rather, about some of the candidates on the Republican side, particularly Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. I've got two Latino candidates here. It's been pointed out before that the Republican field of primary candidates is pretty diverse. But you say on your blog that these two are kind of outliers. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was trying to look at how similar they may be to what may be considered a typical Latino, if you look, if you judge it by what the census says a typical Latino looks like or is. And they're both outliers. They're kind of outside in many ways of that typical Latino experience. Ted Cruz more so than Marco Rubio for the following reasons. Ted Cruz, number one. Well, going back, first of all, the majority of the Latinos in this country are Mexican and Mexican-American. Right. And so here you have, in one presidential campaign, two Cubans who are vying for the Republican presidential nomination. That's very unusual because it's not coming from the largest Latino group. Mm-hmm. Of the two, Marco Rubio has the most recognizable Latino background because he comes from Miami. And when you think of the Cuban population, almost all lines lead to Miami as the entry point and obviously being the greatest concentration of Cuban population in the country. Whereas Ted Cruz comes from Canada.
Careful, Maria, careful.
Well, and even among folks on my Facebook feed and Twitter, it's like, I've never heard of a Cuban from Canada. That's very, very unusual. So you start looking at things like that. Marco Rubio speaks Spanish. Ted Cruz does not. And Spanish, while most Latinos in this country speak English, most Latinos also speak Spanish at home. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he doesn't know Spanish is one of those things that also makes Ted Cruz an outlier. And there are a lot of other things like that that you start to look at, and they're kind of outside of that Latino experience that both Republicans, when the majority of Latino elected officials, if you go by some organizations that track this, are in fact Democrat, with the exception of Florida, because Florida, the elected officials, both at the Hispanic elected officials at the state and federal level, tend to be Cuban and tend to be Republican.
Yeah. Frank Torres, just before we move on from politics, I want to come back to you. Speaking of Latinos and the Latino vote, Jeb Bush, of course, you know, had that sort of pitch to Latino voters, Hispanic voters particularly, right. Spanish-speaking voters rather, early in his campaign. He's not doing so well. Does he have any kind of a traction with the Latino vote, do you think?
You know, Jeb Bush speaks the language, and he speaks it very well. I mean, he's not what they call a poser. I think that reflects very positively with Latino voters. His Central Florida swing that he did back here towards the fall was in East Orlando and a couple of stops out there and places where are typically left-leaning districts and or left-leaning areas and have a large Hispanic-speaking audience. So I think he does very well from them. The problem is it's not just the Latino votes in the Republican primary. That's a very small group to have favorability over. And he's competing with that with Marco Rubio, who also speaks the language and has more considerable amount of charisma than Jeb Bush does. So I don't see it as the only group that's going to be able to save him. I think if he can somehow power through this primary and make it into the general election, I think it would be a huge plus on his side. But it's not going to be enough to save him in the primary.
Do you think it makes much difference that his wife is Hispanic?
I think it does. That's another face on the campaign trail that shows him that it's not just a talking point for him. It's family. It's personal involvement.
But he hasn't been able to articulate that. If you think back a couple of debates where Donald Trump was kind of getting into it with him and he wasn't really able to sort of stand up for himself there.
That's right. And that's where this whole wimp image is coming from. And that's why he's getting tagged into the late night television shows for not sticking up to him. You know, if he had one of those, you know, this is my I bought this microphone moments and slammed his hand on the podium and really stuck with Donald Trump, it could revive, jumpstart his entire campaign. But we haven't seen that. So,
Maria.
But I think that his problem is even bigger than that, in the sense that Jeb Bush was governor of Florida, I think it was 8 years ago. And in that period of time, we've had a huge influx of newcomers. So there are a huge chunk of new voters out there who have absolutely no experience of Jeb Bush, regardless of whether you are Latino or not Latino. They just don't really know who Jeb Bush is. They don't know what he may or may not have accomplished while he was governor, two-term governor here in Florida. He's got to reintroduce himself to all these folks. And oftentimes what I hear, Frank, when I am watching the debates is he's just sort of stating, well, I have experience. I'm a governor. And I don't know that people know what that means. Tell me what that means.
You know, there was a trending topic on Twitter. It was when Jeb was president.
Right, yeah.
I know a lot of people
When Jeb was governor,
When Jeb was governor, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of funny throwback tweets attached to that hashtag.
Mm-hmm. MySpace was the social media network.
MySpace was the social media network. A lot of young professionals. When Jeb was governor, I was in high school. Mm-hmm. You know, so, so there's a lot of accuracy to Maria's statement. But, you know, it's he's got a lot of money. I mean, these media buys need to start hitting where they need to hit in order to resonate in the polls.
Well, and remember, one of the things he's been involved with since he left the governor's office is his education foundation, which has been a prime backer of Common Core, which, while had a lot of support initially, is starting to become kind of toxic. Mm-hmm. So he has to deal with that, too.
Yeah, there's a complex kind of array of factors weighing down on Jeb Bush right now. We listen to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to move on from politics. When we come back, we'll talk about fracking. Seminole County Commissioners vote to ban fracking, joining other municipalities statewide. But what effect does that ban have? Do you want your county to join in as well? We're taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252. Also talk about a lawsuit filed by Morgan & Morgan against Monster Energy Drinks. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, presenting a new 12-story women's hospital filled with experts in preventative health, personalized maternity services, and the highest level of specialty care, all in one place. Florida Hospital for women, because women are one of the reasons life is amazing.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Nicole Creston. Good morning. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout your day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices. Just search WMFE in the App Store or Google Play Store.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Career Source Florida, a statewide network of employment professionals who help businesses compete and grow. Career Source Florida assists with recruiting, hiring, and training needs. Businesses can apply for grants and find resources at careersourceflorida.com. Career Source Florida, solutions that work for you.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the studio, Mike Lafferty, former editor with the Orlando Sentinel, Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer, and Maria Padilla with the Orlando Latino blog. Now, Seminole County is taking a stand against fracking. It's not the only county that opposes fracking. Dozens of other local governments are in the same boat. But the ban comes as Florida legislators consider a bill that would override local authorities, essentially stopping them from enforcing any kind of ban on fracking. So what impact does this ban have? Now, fracking involves injecting water and chemicals deep underground to release reserves of oil and gas. Supporters say it helps remove U.S. dependence on foreign oil and gas and boost the economy, but opponents say Florida, with its fragile limestone atop the underground aquifer, is no place for fracking. We're at 1-866-338-5252. 1-866-338-5252. Is fracking a possibility in your neighborhood? Should we fear it, or is it worth consideration as part of the energy mix for Florida? 1-866-338-5252. We're taking your calls. Mike Lafferty, fracking is pretty much unheard of in Florida to date, but is it kind of inevitable that will eventually make its way here?
Well, fracking might be unheard of here, but actually other types of oil drilling are not. There are some wells still being pumped in Florida, in the southwest part of the state too. So I couldn't say whether it's inevitable or not. I can say, though, that I was surprised to see Seminole County take such a such an adamant position on it, because Seminole County is a very Republican county. It's I believe the entire county commission is composed of Republicans. This was a unanimous vote, and it wasn't just a vote that said we oppose it generally. It was a vote to ban it. And so that did come as a bit of a surprise, and I think might reflect that in Florida, even though when it comes to the environment, you don't see a lot of support for on the state level these days for environmental initiatives. But the people of Florida really care about their state a lot, and mm-hmm. they are worried about things like this. So I think this vote says something about the sentiment in the state right now mm-hmm. When it comes to fracking.
Just back to your point about the commission vote there, though. I mean, whether they're Republican or Democrat is a one factor, but there's also kind of an image of Seminole County, and that's something that they want to protect, clearly, which is, you know, has this image of being a pretty kind of unspoiled place comparatively.
Right, the natural choice, I think.
Exactly,
they call
yeah,
themselves.
That's their tagline. Mm-hmm. So they do have an image to uphold. You know, that's part of the reason people move there is because there's this, you know, greenery on your backyard. Sometimes it brings bears and the like, but there is an advantage to that.
Right, right. And, yeah, I wasn't suggesting because they were Republicans they would necessarily be lockstep with all Republican positions. But, mm-hmm. you know, the GOP has been a stronger supporter of exploration,
right.
Energy exploration, than Democrats. But you're right. Seminole County positions itself as sort of the natural alternative to the theme parks and the other things you find to the south of them. So mm-hmm. I'm sure they're thinking it's not in their best interests to have whatever sort of infrastructure it would take mm-hmm. to do fracking in their county.
Mm-hmm. Going to take a call here. We've got Matthew. Matthew, Matthew, you're on the air. What's your thought?
Hey, guys. Well, my thoughts are very simple. I do understand the idea that fracking helps to reduce our dependence on oil. There's no mm-hmm. doubt about that. But if we are going to simultaneously poison our drinking supply, it doesn't make sense because we don't import water from around the world, right? We get our water from the ground. And mm-hmm. chemicals that are put underneath the ground do not disappear. At best, they will pile up and they will become massive quantities, and then they will come into our water supply. All of our water comes from the ground, and Florida specifically is very much a big lake underground. The Everglades are a 50-mile-wide water supply that goes mm-hmm. across the state. So it makes sense for us to reduce our dependence, but not if it puts ourselves in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. I guess the companies that pursue fracking as, you know, a way to get to those resources say, well, there's, you know, they're not convinced, or they say there's not enough evidence when you make that link between fracking and poisoning the water, as you say. So, you know, there is that argument too.
Well, you know, that's a great argument that someone who's going to benefit from our exploitation and doesn't live in the state, if they say that there's no evidence to support the fact that they are going to poison our water supply, let's put a law into place that says if it does happen that they have mandatory jail sentences and their companies will be forced out of business. Let's put that into the law and then let's see what they say then.
Matthew, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate your calling in on this issue. Maria, let me just turn that over to you. The idea of energy independence, I mean, we obviously get some of our listeners think it's something that's important, but not that important when you compare it to the safety and the health of the drinking water. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the energy independence is very important. And in fact, the United States is very close to being energy independent precisely because of things like fracking. Having said that, as Mike said earlier, this is Florida. And I do think that people do care about the environment here in Florida. That is one of the reasons why people come to Florida, because it is such a beautiful state. And our water supply in the state is very fragile. Mm-hmm. We are not doing enough to protect our aquifers. We are tapping into it at enormous rate speed because of expansion of our population. And not a whole lot is being done to protect that. So I think there has to be some sort of balance. I don't know that people are really have fracking at top of the mind or really understand what it is, except that it's a word that's being thrown around a lot. Mm-hmm. But I do think that people do care about what happens to Florida.
Mm-hmm. Frank, let me turn this over to you. So there's this bill in the House to you know, basically preempt whatever local legislators do. What's the future of this bill?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that bill because I covered both commissions in Seminole and Orange and Lake, which also passed it. And I was talking to a lot of state lawmakers about this. And there's sort of this rivalry between these state lawmakers and these county commissioners. You've got this county commissioner saying, hey, you're not going to tell us what to do. You know, mm-hmm. this is our turf. This is the local government, and you guys are overriding us. And the state lawmakers are just sort of waving them off, and like, oh, we'll see about that. And I think there's a lot of rivalry. I think there's some rivalry involved. Maybe, you know, it's even some lawmakers are even taking it personally on some levels. You'll recall some of these Seminole County commissioners. Seminole County Commissioner Brenda Carey was on television saying that, you know, these state lawmakers still have to come back home and run for election. I think some of those forget that.
Right.
And I'm quoting her when I say that. So there's this, you know, sort of resentment on both sides of both levels of government trying to be out front on this issue. And I think it's a really interesting dynamic in the discussion.
Do some of these commissioners have their sights set on the state, though? Are they kind of looking to ramp things up there?
You know, lawmakers are always looking at the next level and what they think they can bring to it. We have a one state Senate candidate right now who's made fracking part of his platform, who's running out there in a part of what I believe is Seminole County as well. So, yeah, fracking will be an interesting, neat little sub-issue or in the coming elections.
Yeah, this is also kind of gets to the tension between the legislature and municipalities and counties about home rule. I think they – and the municipalities and cities and counties for a long time have wanted the state to stay out of their business, and the state oftentimes does not. So I think this is a manifestation of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an example, as Mike was saying, that everyone loves, in theory, the idea of home rule and local government until home rule and local government does something that is not to your liking.
Right.
This is where the rubber meets the road.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call here. We've got Mustafa. What are your thoughts on fracking, Mustafa?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment here that fracking is basically allowed only on a political level. If you look at it from a scientific standpoint, there is no argument at all. Anywhere that fracking has been allowed, it's only been on political lines. Any time that it has not been allowed, it is because it has been proved scientifically that it is harmful. There is no doubt about, there's no argument about that. And the reason people, you know, companies are, the fracking companies are able to make any sort of argument out of this is because they went initially in areas that were not that populated. So the sample size of complaints and effects and all that was so small then.
Mm-hmm.
But now they want to bring it into areas that are very populated. And that's why they're getting the pushback. And the pushback is winning because on a scientific standpoint, they cannot lose. It is harmful to the environment. It is bad for the water, and every place that it's been allowed, it's been purely on political lines. It's kind of like the saying that the banking, you can make an analogy of it with the banking industry. You know, none of the bankers have been jailed. That doesn't mean that they did not do anything wrong. Everybody knows. And it's been proven that they did things wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let me just throw the idea, though. I mean, you make the political argument there, sure, but what about the economic argument? Because you can't argue with the fact that some of those states where they have had fracking, it's been a boon. You know, there've been communities spring up around the fracking wellheads, and it's been good economically in some cases.
No, I mean, that's just numbers. The reality is different. The boom has only been where the hotels have come up, where the workers who are working on the fracking wells can get to live. That is not, I mean, that's not a boom. It's basically a requirement for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you notice that those same workers who are living in those same areas have had health problems. It's not like they haven't. If you actually dig down into the numbers, you'll see a lot more problems than benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that these companies, they have a lot of money and they have great, you know, people who are great at media. So everything, the message that gets out are all the positives. But if you dig down, the negatives are far outweigh the positives. And that's why places like Seminole County, when they vote this down, they're voting that based on proof of science and of the results.
Mm-hmm.
It's not politically.
Mm-hmm.
It's very politically divided.
There may be some politics involved in the vote down too, because, you know, fracking's unpopular, and I think, you know, folks are going to say, well, look, we'll take us down. But look, Mustafa, I do appreciate your call. Thank you so much for getting your voice on the air there. Let me just bring this back to you for a moment. Frank, what do you make of this stand from Seminole County? Does it have legs? Is there kind of strength in numbers here? You talk about the other counties that have put this ban in place.
You know, I know a lot of commissioners listen to this program, and the sad news is no, it doesn't. I believe their convictions are real. I believe there's a lot of parties that are really passionate about this subject, like our two previous callers. But, they're one commissioner in Osceola County phrased this as feel-good ordinances or feel-good legislation. And at that point, that's what it is. If they are – maybe the positive outcome could be the media, mm-hmm. and maybe sort of coalition building behind the press that this is getting, the attention that this issue is getting. But otherwise, it is essentially feel-good legislation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move on now and just talk quickly about another story that's hit the headlines in Orlando, at least, from fracking to energy drinks. Orlando law firm Morgan & Morgan suing the maker of popular Monster energy drinks. The firm filed 5 lawsuits this week against the company. Attorneys say the high-caffeine drink gave a 14-year-old a stroke, and they're investigating 100 similar claims of heart attacks and kidney failures in cases involving teenagers and adults in their 40s. Just hear a little bit from attorney Mike Morgan taking issue with the way Monster advertises these drinks.
It's extreme athletes. It's video games. They are targeting our children. They are going after our kids and getting them hooked.
Well, Morgan & Morgan wants the FDA to require warning labels on the cans. Meanwhile, the energy drink company says it will, quote, vigorously defend the suit, and it says the law firm is trying to make a cottage industry out of taking on energy drinks. Is this a publicity stunt, and should there be a warning label on the cans of energy drinks? Maria, let me just turn this question over to you. What do you make of the argument that kids are prone to the kind of advertising these drink companies are putting out here?
I think that's probably true, and it may be similar to the tobacco ads that were often aimed at kids as tobacco use among adults started to decline. You mm-hmm. had the Joe Camel personality, for instance, that sure. was clearly aimed at youth. And out of that came the whole Truth campaign and other campaigns to combat that and to keep children or, you know, adolescents from smoking. And I think that has been a big success. I don't think that that kids of a certain age really understand what the energy drinks are about and what they can do to your heart rate right. if you combine it with other things. And so that makes them a very vulnerable population that, like the cigarette ads, they have to be protected from that kind of message, I think, and mm-hmm. at least, you know, somewhat, because they're vulnerable to it.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder, how much good is a warning label going to do on a drink can if a kid is going out to the convenience store and buying it? Mm-hmm. Because if the parents aren't stopping them from buying it in the first place, I don't know what difference it would make to put a warning label on a can.
Well, it had an amazing effect on cigarette packages to put a warning label, health warning label on it. So we don't know.
You have to be a certain age to buy a pack of cigarettes. You don't have to be a certain age to buy a Monster.
Do you think there's a bit of a case of buyer beware, though, Mike Lafferty? I mean, one of the cases that Morgan & Morgan talked about, a man in his 40s had a stroke after drinking 6 energy drinks a day, which seems like a little bit excessive.
It does, yeah. I don't know why someone's drinking 6 cans of that a day. I mean, there are a lot of products that are on the shelves right now that if you consume too much of something, it can have some ill effects on your body. I'm just not quite sure where this is all going. You know, I just wonder if it's going to be something akin to, you know, New York City banning a certain size of, right. of soft drink. You know, I don't know. I mm-hmm. don't know if it's really going to have that much effect, especially the warning label thing. Mm-hmm. Kids don't pay attention to warning labels. I don't think kids are paying attention to warning labels on cigarette packs.
I think so. I think smoking is down among
kids. Smoking
is
down, yeah. But I think there are other factors besides warning labels that are responsible mm-hmm. for that.
Frank, let me just bring this to you for a minute. I mean, Mike Morgan saying there he wants the FDA to get involved. Could that happen?
It takes a face and it takes a few incidences. If there's a trend, you'll see them get involved. You know, it's not exactly energy drinks, but I remember the Four Loko controversy from a couple years ago. A ridiculous amount of alcohol in a beverage that was relatively easy to put away. And, you know, I consume an energy drink from time to time. You know, we all work long hours and you need that extra pep in your step, you know, late at night. And, you know, I'll take one in. And it does feel at times like, you know, it is a jolt. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I noticed about the advertising, though, I think is interesting, is they're sort of taking the sports drink craze from, you know, the 90s and the early part of the last decade and sort of merging it into the energy drink trade. So you're seeing athletes sort of promoting the drink in the want to be like Mike sort of trend or fashion. Mm-hmm. So I think the advertising is the really interesting part of this discussion. These things are really getting geared towards the younger audiences and the younger consumers.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Still to come, we're going to talk a little bit about medical marijuana. It could be $1.5 billion industry in Florida in the next few years if it can become more broadly available. So are you waiting for the green gold rush, and is it worth it for the Sunshine State? Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from the Stetson University Master of Arts in Creative Writing Low Residency Program, hosting an information session on Thursday, February 18th at 5:30 p.m. at the Starbucks Coffee on the DeLand campus. This two-year hybrid program consists of classroom, workshops, and online work. More information available at stetson.edu/gograd.
Good morning, I'm Nicole Creston. This is Intersection. In your forecast, mostly sunny skies today and warmer with afternoon highs reaching the mid to upper 70s and no rain expected. Overnight lows in the mid 50s. For the weekend, daytime highs drop a bit into the upper 60s both days.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Aggressive Appliances, a family-owned company that has been selling, installing, and servicing appliances in Central Florida for 35 years. Aggressive Appliances specializes in luxury brands and features galleries of live working kitchens. Learn more at aggressiveappliances.com. Aggressive Appliances, a deeper commitment to appliances and the people who love them.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Mike Lafferty, with the former Orlando Sentinel editor, Maria Padilla, editor of the OrlandoLatino.org blog, and Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. And you can join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Well, medical marijuana reform in Florida could open the floodgates for a whole new industry, and it could be worth a whole lot of money to the Sunshine State. But first, medical marijuana has its detractors, of course. The profits could be enormous, according to the State of Legal Marijuana. Excuse me. According to the State of Legal Marijuana Markets Report, legal marijuana in the U.S. is projected to grow to $21.8 billion. That's what the industry should be worth by 2020. The report says Florida is one of the four states best positioned to legalize medical marijuana. Here's John Kagea, Director of Industry Analytics for New Frontier. He's also an editor of that report.
But by 2020, once the market is fully operational, once the patient registration counts have grown, we anticipate that the Florida market will have grown to nearly $1.5 billion by 2020.
That's John Kagea, one of the authors of that report, saying that basically medical marijuana could be worth a lot of money to Florida should it be legalized. He also says seniors in Florida could play a big role, more patients with conditions like cancer that may turn to medical marijuana. Maria, let me start with you. How do you see the medical marijuana debate shaking out with voters this November? And just kind of thinking back to Attorney John Morgan's push to target older voters this time around, because 2 years ago it didn't seem to work well enough when he targeted the younger voters.
That's correct. Older voters are the ones that voted against the medical marijuana in the state of Florida, while the young voters actually went for it in big, big, big numbers. So he knows that he's got to really address that audience and address whatever their concerns might be. I don't know. Marijuana seems to be aimed at two markets. Either you're really very young and you use it very recreationally, or you're old and parts of you are falling apart, and so you need it to keep you feeling a little bit better. You might have a disease, or you might have something that you need to that helps calm you down. So mm-hmm. there's like two very distinct markets for marijuana, but a lot of it is still revolving around the recreational use of marijuana. Mm-hmm. I don't know, and I think seniors have a very big concern about that.
Mike, what have you noticed in maybe a changing attitude to medical marijuana, maybe voters kind of softening up to the idea of medical marijuana in your time as a journalist here in Florida?
Well, the polls seem very clear that there seems to be enormous support for medical marijuana and to a lesser degree for recreational marijuana. There was a Q poll back in April that had 84% of the people polled supporting medical marijuana, and 55%, this was a surprise to me, supporting legalizing recreational use of marijuana. And if you look at some of these cities and counties in South Florida, they have reduced the penalties. They've essentially turned possession of small amounts of marijuana into what amounts to a traffic ticket.
Right.
So that's a big change.
Mm-hmm. Frank, implementation of medical marijuana bill that passed in 2014 still hasn't really come about because of lawsuits, red tape. Is it premature to say Florida's medical marijuana marketplace could be worth that $1.5 billion? Is that kind of a a chimera?
You know, I don't think so, because a lot of people thought that this was going to pass in 2014. And if you look at – I started noticing that a lot of convention halls, a lot of venues were booked by these medical marijuana facilitators to help, trying to help people get into the business by some angle. And so – it was just, and we're not talking maybe one or two incidences. We're talking about at least over a dozen of these companies that are meant to help people get into the medical marijuana industry. So there, that's an indication that there is some financial gain to be made there at some level of the business. You know, and John Morgan's switching up his strategy this time.
Mm-hmm.
At the press conference, he's like, you know, I tried to go for the young people in 2014 and they didn't show up and vote. This time I'm going to go after the older group and I'm going to convince them what medical marijuana can do in the areas of pain management and try to get them to see the benefits involved with that. So I think that's really where we're going as far as this medical marijuana fight. If there is any, there isn't a lot of opposition is heading in, into the election cycle.
Mm-hmm. Going to go to the phones now. We've got Dr. Andrea Cleese, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, calling from Daytona Beach. What's on your mind?
Yeah, you know, I have so many issues with medical marijuana. My anxiety is that in many of the other states, it started out with medical marijuana accepting, and then it converted into social marijuana. Mm. And there's, you know, we just don't see the states and the conflicts that are happening. But if you go to the state of Colorado or California and you talk to the people locally, there's a lot of anger and a lot of frustration about having it.
Mm-hmm.
Revenue-wise, it helped the state significantly. But the problem is they see their youth becoming complacent and not getting engaged. They see more crime. They see a lot that homes are blowing up because they're cooking this down to more aggressive. So it starts with a medical concept, and then it gets in the hands of the consumers that can purchase it more easily, and then it becomes a very dangerous situation.
Hang on a minute. Let me just bring you back to you said homes are blowing up because people are cooking down marijuana.
Yeah, when we were in Colorado just 2 weeks ago. There were several people that documented home fires as a result of these kids burning down the marijuana to access the more potent form, I guess Dapin or something. I don't really know the terminology, but yet I did not see any newspaper articles, you know, and yet I don't see any newspaper articles about the negative side and the conflicts. Mm-hmm. I sat and talked to a mother who was an advocate on a mother's advocacy group to get marijuana because they felt that they were entitled to have the freedom of choice to choose and not be regulated by government. And she said, what a mistake I made. If I could reverse my decision, I would absolutely reverse my decision on marijuana. This is so bad for our youth. I don't know what I've done.
Mm-hmm. What's your sense, Dr. Clizo, of what voters are going to do in November? Do you think the pro-medical marijuana reform folks are going to push this through, or do you think folks are going to take a look at states like Colorado, you know, where you say there are problems, say, well, maybe we need to take a pause on this?
My anxiety is that there's a lot of things going on out there that people are not aware of. A lot of my patients don't realize doctors can give marijuana. Mm-hmm. And maybe there needs to be research in marijuana. I know University of Florida is looking at seizures particularly, but maybe there needs to be more research on the treatment of pain before we just push it through.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the data needs to come out before we put it into our society and put it into our community. Because once medical is passed, then it becomes a social situation. And yes, it may help revenues, which is fantastic. I'm all for revenue enhancement. However, is if the cost of our youth, where they become complacent, who's going to take care of us when they don't want to work?
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate that call from a concerned doctor there. And let me just kind of bring this back to you, Mike Lafferty. I mean, what are your thoughts? Do you think that the voters are going to go for this in November? Are the older voters going to get behind medical marijuana?
Oh, it's hard to say. I mean, again, I'm just looking at the polls. The polls seem to show a lot of support for it. The thing almost passed last time around, and that was 2014, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you get a bigger – if you get a bigger turnout in 2016, if you, the bigger turnout means more younger people are coming to the polls, sure, it could pass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced because all the polls last time in 2014 said that it would pass, and it did not. Mm-hmm. Again, it lost by a very small margin. but it did not pass. I was reading a RAND Corporation study the other day that just quickly said in Arizona alone, 19 tons of medical marijuana were consumed in 2015.
How did they figure that out?
It was a survey. It was a survey that was done, and 2,000 people in four Western states that have medical marijuana laws. Males outnumber females 2-to-1 in the consumption of medical marijuana. And the interesting thing, the other interesting thing that I read about it was that they looked at, well, when is the consumption of marijuana, medical marijuana, highest? And it was around the holidays. So around the Christmas holidays, the consumption of medical marijuana went up considerably. And I thought that was very interesting because it really hints more toward recreational use than it does to pain management.
Yeah, but, you know, some people injure themselves around the holidays. It's a stressful time. So maybe there's that argument as well.
Possibly. And lifting that glass and lifting that plate of food, that's possible.
Maria Padilla is a former reporter with the Orlando Sentinel, also editor of the OrlandoLatino.org blog. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Mike Laverty, former Orlando Sentinel editor. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you.
And Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thank you so much, Frank.
Thanks so much.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welsh. Support for today's show from Abe Abariah and Nicole Kristen. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.